I'm really excited about tonight, because not only am I introducing this, I'm one of the speakers here in a minute, but this book that's out, it's the first time I've seen it myself and been able to touch it. Even though it's taken a lot of blood, sweat, and tears over the last few years. And so welcoming you here tonight, I would also like to have you join me in a word of prayer as we begin our time together. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much for your presence here with us, for your revelation, Lord, and your word in this world that you made. Lord, thank you for the ways that we can know you through your revelation, through the person of Christ, through the Holy Spirit given to us. We welcome you in here now, Lord, and ask that you would superintend over our time in all of our thoughts and the words that are said, Lord. May you be the focus of our attention, and may you receive the glory. So thank you so much, Lord, for your presence. Lead and guide, Lord, we pray this now in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, with that, my next task is to introduce our speakers. So the four of us are part of a five-member team. John Walton. Right there, who gave you a ticket, is a fifth member of our Theories of Origins teaching team. That class, for the last 8-9 years now, has happened right in this room, so it'll be very natural for us to talk about these things again with you here. Out of this course, we developed this textbook, and you'll hear more about that from our speakers. So we start with Robert Bishop, who physics and philosophy training, endowed chair in the history and philosophy of science here at Wheaton College, who wrote not just the physics and cosmology part of the book, but as well much of the theological part of it. Dr. Steve Mosier, who will bring the origins of the Earth to light, has been here from the very first time this course was offered. In 1995. Dr. Larry Funk in chemistry has been with this course 17, 18 years, I think, in this. And then I've been part of this course for something like 22 out of its 25 years of existence, for most of it as well. So we're looking forward to sharing with you a little bit about sort of an overview of the science. You heard an overview of the theology earlier. Tonight, we get an overview of the science. We'll start with Robert Bishop.
There we go. Okay, so, we got to actually switch.
I'll do that for you.
You do that. So Ray mentioned that this book actually was generated out of a course that's been ongoing for over 2 decades now. I'm actually the youngster among all of the teaching teams for the course, because I've only been doing it 10 or so years now. So I'm sort of still a youngster in terms of being Wheaton faculty members, because there have been people in here 20, 30, 40 years. So this is the full team right here, and this is the lovely cover of the book that we're all really excited to see. And let me say a little bit about sort of the history. So this course, which has always been a general education science course, a non-lab course, was introduced in the spring of 1995. As part of what at that point was a kind of revision to what we now call the Legacy General Education Program. And some of you may have actually come in under that program or been associated with most of the students I'm looking at here are probably under the new program, Christ at the Core, which this course has been only slightly retooled in order to fit in with that particular course. It's always been a team-taught course. because the idea of the course was to find some way to be able to bring in the expertise from biblical and theological and philosophical and various scientific perspectives and bring them together in conversation about how to think about the contemporary theories of origins. We stress to our students that we don't talk about all theories of origins. We focus on what might be considered the mainstream scientific theories and then how we can think about those in theological perspective. One of the challenges with when you propose a course, or you're even thinking about doing a course as a faculty member, is the question of, is there a book? Well, it's not just, is there a book, is there a good book that you can use for the course? Because there are bad books out there and you shouldn't use those. But is there a good book that will actually serve the needs of students in terms of the objectives that you have for the course? For something like this, which draws across everything from astronomy all the way to geology in terms of the sciences, and then also connects with theology and basically sort of philosophy of science, epistemology, understanding ways of knowing, the answer is no. There's nothing out there. So for decades, what this course consisted of was a whole lot of readings from a chapter from a book here, a website here, a video to see here, and that made for a course that, despite our best efforts, still had a kind of sense of lack of coherence to it. So we had been thinking about, what we really need. A textbook that actually pulls all of these things together so the students aren't having to do this kind of scattershot, or what feels like a kind of scattershot thing over and over and over again. The BioLogos Foundation, which you can go to their website and read a bit about who they are, they actually put together a funding grant program that we wrote a proposal to be able to actually get some money to write the book. We won. Our proposal was one of the winning proposals. There were several winning proposals in the grant, and that spanned over the time frame from 2013 to 2015. The grant money ran out. The book was not quite finished. We found a way to keep working on it. John, you should stand up.
Yeah.
Just so we can say, this is our editor from InterVarsity Press. InterVarsity Press was excited about the project from the first moment that I mentioned, hey, do you guys think you'd like to look at something like this? We could put a proposal together. Yes, was sort of the enthusiastic response. The book is, a year later than what we thought it would be. That's never happened in the history of IVP publishing, I'm sure. It's also a little bit larger than we said it would be. That's also never happened. Amazing that we've broken all kinds of records. Its official release date is December 4th, for which we'll have we'll actually have a kind of little program downstairs in the display area underneath Perry. Next Tuesday afternoon, there will be books available to buy. You can probably get authors to sign your book, which will double its value on eBay immediately, because we are so well known and so well liked. All right, so that's kind of the background to why we ended up writing a book that we hope not only serves our course well, but provides an opportunity for other schools who are interested in doing some kind of course that examines different areas of the scientific theories of origins and brings biblical and theological perspectives to that, so that now they can say, oh, we can do a course because there's a book. We can actually use a book, and it's a good book, too. So we hope that happens. But also anybody who's just interested in science and religion in general, I think will find this book unique, because they'll actually learn a lot of hardcore science in it. And we're going to say a little bit about that in terms of the overview that I'm going to give you now. Let me sort of switch modes now to talking a little bit about the book itself. So this is the overview of the book. It starts with basically biblical and theological perspectives, and then goes to cosmology, and then the origin of the Earth and the solar system, origin of life, origin and diversification of species, human origins, and then a concluding postscript where we think a little bit about the implications of all that's gone before for how we think about the new creation that is coming in Christ, that is future to us, the environment in terms of creation care and so forth. So part one, actually, John Walton and I in September, at our September meeting, talked a little bit about what's going on in part one. I should also say that all of us as authors feel a little bit like we're engaged in kind of shameless self-promotion, actually using a chapter meeting of the American Scientific Affiliation Wheaton Midway chapter to talk about our book. But I assure you that the planning committee was really enthusiastic about that idea as well. And the planning committee does have non-authors on it. There are some authors on the planning committee too, but they actually did convince us that this would be a really good idea. People would be interested, and I'm looking around the room and seeing that we don't have any chairs left. So apparently the planning committee was right. There's a lot of interest in this sort of thing. To sort of make up for that, hopefully every one of you got a ticket, because we'll do a giveaway. Somebody's, we're going to do one, two?
We're
going to do books. So two people are going to walk out tonight with free books. So that makes up, that's a little bit of penance for our feeling a bit shameful about what we're doing. So John and I talked a little bit about the doctrine of creation last time and how that's connected to biblical, theological, and also philosophical ways of knowing. So this theme of ways of knowing actually translates throughout the book, because one of the things we want readers to be able to understand is how can one take the Bible as a source of knowledge that we can then bring into a conversation about things that are actually outside of the Bible, like what scientists are doing. And when you start talking about ways of knowing, you need to talk a little bit about epistemology, the way philosophers talk about and try to analyze what is knowledge, how do we gain knowledge, is there just kind of one type of knowledge, is this science-y thing, or is there more than that going on? Our argument is that there's a lot more than just science as a way of knowing. So we talked a little bit about that last time. And that actually sets the foundation for the rest of the book. Because what we do in each of the other parts is then begin to describe in some amount of detail what are the different kinds of ways of knowing that scientists in these different areas, astronomy, cosmology, chemistry, biology, geology, and so forth. How is it that they come to the conclusions that they come to? Some of the conclusions that scientists come to may be things that you didn't, that doesn't quite sound like what you grew up with, perhaps, or what your church background is like, and so forth. So we've taken great pains to try to explain that. So my task in part two was to talk about cosmic origins. I should also say, throughout the book, we have interjected, as you'll see here, chapter 5, cosmic origins, Genesis 1 through 2, verse 4 in chapter 2, chapters from Dr. John Walton that bring various kinds of biblical perspectives in for things like cosmic history, earth history, human history, and so forth. Continuing that sort of ways of knowing theme, that there's more than just science that we have to think about, if we're going to think richly about God's good creation. In part two, we focus a lot on astronomers' ways of knowing. So, for example, thinking about things like the properties of light. Right now, we can see each other because there's this thing called light that works in particular sorts of regular ways that enables us to be able to see. But there's a whole lot more to seeing than just the light that is what we call the visible range of our eyes. There's an entire spectrum of light, if you will, from the very, 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 very low frequency end to the very, 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 very high frequency end. So if you think about, and this I don't have a picture of, although I should have, you know, grabbed one from somewhere. If you think about taking the electromagnetic spectrum light and you imagine spanning it between New York City and Los Angeles, the visible spectrum that we see with our eyes, it would be the width of a dime on a map that is spanning that distance. So we see very little with our eyes. So we need instruments that can allow us to look across this entire space. If anybody's a Star Trek Next Generation fan, you know there's this guy named Geordi who's got this interesting sort of visor that allows him to see in all the frequency ranges. Scientists don't have anything like that, but we've got all kinds of different telescopes that we've built over the years that allow us to be able to see that entire suite. And that allows us to be able to see things like, or to take those properties of light, for example, and make inferences about how old the universe is. So one of the things we try to explain is, how is it that scientists come up with this age range? Right now it's about 14.7, 14.8 billion years old. How is it that astronomers can have some confidence that they think that that's what the age is? So we try to explain how they get to that. How it is that we understand things like how big is the universe? So for instance, in terms of light years, right, that's the distance light can travel in 1 year at 186,000 miles per second. And you see there's 10 to the 10. That's one with 10 zeros. After, that's a lot of light years. That's the you can't even with your mind conceive of just how far away some of these objects are that astronomers are observing. And not only that, discoveries like, for example, that our universe is expanding. It's actually growing over time from some starting point a long, long time ago when it was a baby universe. It was very tiny, smaller than you were as a baby. Think about that. To something that is so large you can't even imagine. And the expansion is still going on. How is it that we figured stuff like that out? Well, we try to explain in part one all of the different sorts of characteristics of creation, various kinds of elements of its functional integrity, to use a kind of technical term, how it is that we can take those regularities of creation that God has given to creation and then infer and understand all of these different aspects of a universe that's so big, it leaves us naturally thinking, wow, God is an amazing God. So it actually ends up being a worship experience to work on these kinds of things. Along with that, we've also looked at things, or talk a little bit about, say, the properties of light that is emitted from atoms and the special sort of ways in which those give you a kind of fingerprint for each kind of chemical element that allows you to be able to determine all kinds of information about the universe. One particularly interesting and relevant piece of information is why it is so specially tuned for life. We could be here tonight having a conversation that is really excited about this book, like this book, man. We can only do that because there are these properties in the universe that actually are so well tuned that it makes life possible. Not only makes it possible, it makes it able to actually thrive so we can have a conversation this evening about how cool it is that there are these properties in the universe that make it possible for life to thrive. And here we are, we can study it, we can understand it, we can get all excited about it, and so forth. So that, in a nutshell, is sort of what goes on in part one in terms of the ways of knowing of astronomers and then the ways of the knowing of the geologists, of the chemists, of the biologists and so forth are discussed in the succeeding parts of the book. And for that, I will then turn over to Dr. Mosher, because basically I get us to the point where we've created a whole bunch of elements and he's the one who has to actually put them together and make a wolf on Earth. Isn't that amazing? That he can do that.
All right, thank you. £4.5 is what they said. I'm going to break my foot. You want me to try? Okay.
Well, yeah, now that we have a periodic table of elements produced in the cauldrons of collapsing and exploding stars, Chapter 11 highlights what we know about the origin of our solar system, sun, planets, and the moon. Our theory for how the solar system formed is based on the composition and structure of the solar system, but now we have the ability to observe other solar systems with exoplanets being made around other stars in our galaxy. So in this chapter, we look into what we know about the various theories for the origin of the solar system. And the fascinating thing here is that the prevailing theory really goes all the way back to the 18th century, which is really quite amazing that a theory can stand for that long. The remaining chapters, the remaining seven chapters in part three focus on the natural history of our planet Earth. Chapter 12 explores the historical roots of geology, the study of how our planet works and its natural history of rocks and life. The basic principles of geology are explained in the context of the historical development of geology, with special attention to the engagement of Christians in geology as it emerged, and the reaction of the church to changing ideas about the duration and nature of Earth's history. As geology emerged as a science, there were catastrophists who believed Earth's history was long, actually, but punctuated by great revolutions and upheavals, which they could see in the rock record, such as unconformities and also mass extinctions of fossil species. There were also uniformitarians who believed Earth's history involved the steady and uninterrupted processes of the rock cycle, no more or less than what we observe today. Chapters 14, 15, and 16 provide the reader with background and tools for reading Earth's history. The processes and timescales of the rock cycle, methods for measuring geologic time, and plate tectonics, the prevailing theory of the origin of continents, ocean basins, and mountain belts. Chapter 17, maybe my favorite chapter, provides an overview of Earth's history, building on the backgrounds of the previous chapters. We tell the 4.5 billion year history of the Earth as a sequence of seven scenes with interludes. These are pictures from scene three, Dawn of an Animal Planet, which highlights things that happened during the Cambrian and Ordovician periods of Earth's history. And at this point, I want to mention that all of the graphics in the book are original. We were able to use the grant money to employ students and friends and even some of our children to do some really amazing artwork. And so I was very, very excited about that. And of course, also the grant money was used to purchase rights for using material that was in other textbooks. But it was really wonderful to be able to not just cut and paste figures out of other books, but to really have a continuity of style throughout the book. And I can also say that most of, maybe all of the specimens that are in the chapter, geologic specimens, fossil rocks and minerals, are from our collection here at Wheaton College. So that was another really special thing for me. Many Christians are familiar with creationist arguments against an ancient creation, and in particular claims that the Genesis flood produced most of the sedimentary rock record. So we do consider the merits of many of these most popular claims in part three. And these are located in standalone essays, which we call going further boxes. So here are some of the going further boxes that pertain to some of the ideas that are out there that are alternatives to the mainstream scientific views, and mostly held by Christians. Talking about the consistency of nature's laws, looking at sedimentary rocks, fossils, and flood geology in general, an idea that's out there about rapid plate movement rather than the very slow movement that we observe today and believe can be shown to have happened in the past. Thinking about Precambrian rocks, do they represent rocks from the creation week, for example? Flood geology and Paleozoic stratigraphy, That would be the stratigraphy, that the strata that are exposed in the Grand Canyon, which are often used as kind of the showpiece for flood geology. Stratigraphic cycles in flood geology, these are interesting phenomena that we see in the rock record where a series of beds are repeated over and over, like ABCD, ABCD, and what these tell us about cycles in Earth's history, even having to do with sea level fluctuation and climate change. Dinosaurs in flood geology and the Ice Age in flood geology, these are just a few of the going further boxes in part three, but there are going further boxes in all of the different chapters, which may be biographies of famous scientists, or it might be other special topics that the authors wish to input into the text, but not be a part of the flow of the chapters. Chapter 13 provides background for understanding the ancient Near Eastern context and biblical scholarship on the Genesis flood narrative, and of course that was written by our colleague John Walton. Chapter 18 explores the biblical and theological perspectives on Earth's history by applying principles of the doctrine of creation, which are established early in the book, reviewed early in the book, applying this to questions about Earth's history and looking at how Christians through the ages have interpreted Genesis or attempted to relate scriptural and scientific accounts of Earth's history. I found it interesting and include in here some quotes from writers of the Fundamentals, the papers that were written by many theologians and pastors and Bible scholars that many people feel is the sort of origin of the Fundamentalist movement. And there's a lot about science in there, and a lot of it's really, really good. And so we point that out in the book. And with that, I would like to turn it over to my colleague, Larry Funk, who's going to make life for us.
Chapters either, so you can go see quickly that I had a chance to do five chapters, and so I'm going to skip right to what I really want to talk about. It does relate to the book, don't worry about that. I'm talking about the origin of life. The origin of life actually, from my perspective, turns out to be one of the hardest parts of the story. Back in 1942, Robert Fisher graduated from the chemistry department here at Wheaton, and in the early 1980s, he wrote a book entitled God Did It, But How? And I was struck when I looked at that title about how this really encapsulates the themes of our textbook. There it is. God did it. That's what we're saying. And what we're trying to do is say how he did it. That's the job of science, to try to explain how that process was accomplished, how whatever process we're talking about was accomplished. But we keep in the back of our minds, of course, the fact that it was God who was responsible. It turns out that for the origin of life, it's a really hard question. That's how I started this talk. And here's a quote from Stuart Kaufman, comes from a book that he wrote back in 1995, but it's still true today. Anyone who tells you that he or she knows how life started on the Earth, some 3.45 billion years ago, is a fool or a knave. I like to call the origin of life question the ultimate cold case. Now, why do I call it the ultimate cold case? Well, first of all, it's a mystery. It's really hard to figure out how this happened, okay? So, I'm drawing the analogy to this mystery, this cold case. And why is it cold? Well, it happened a long, long time ago. Estimates from Kaufman on the order of 3.5 billion years ago. But also, all of the molecular materials involved in the process have long since gone out of existence. So the scientists trying to figure out how it happened doesn't have anything to work with, or virtually nothing to work with, to try to figure out the process. That makes it something very much like a cold case mystery. This is one example of where I try to use, in the textbook actually, different metaphors or similes or analogies. This is the first one, and that's kind of a theme of my 10 minutes of talk, okay? Why? How do we know that it was a long, long time ago? This is actually a figure from the text. It's a picture taken through a microscope of a slide that contained a very thin slice of a rock that was dated at 3.4 billion years ago. Okay, I think that was supposed to be a B, but somehow it turned into a G. At any rate, it was 3.4 billion years ago that life is believed to have started, and these are believed to be fossils. Now, how do we know these are fossils and not simply some kind of inorganic materials? Well, it turns out that recently people have developed the capacity to determine the actual isotopic composition of the carbon in structures like that. They use a technique called SIMS, which stands for secondary ionic mass spectrometry. I won't go into the details of that, but what they do is bounce ions off this, knocks out carbon atoms, and you can measure the mass of the carbon atoms, and it turns out that life actually causes, like living systems, like simple microorganisms, actually cause an increase in the composition of carbon-12 versus carbon-13. So you can tell whether the carbon came from a living system, the argument goes, by simply doing this kind of mass spectrometry. And that's how they demonstrated, whoops, I need to go that far ahead. That's how they demonstrated that these things, pressing the wrong button. Sorry. That's how they demonstrated that these things are actually from living systems. It's like carbon. Like carbon is in these things. This is a graph that shows the difference between carbonate carbon, inorganic carbon, and carbon that was not from these little microorganisms, but rather carbon that occurs in graphite deposits. And this stretches back to 4 billion years, roughly, on this diagram. They don't go quite back that far in this diagram. There are a few instances that go back to maybe 3.8 billion years. The point that I'm making is there is evidence for life going back all the way to shortly after the Earth was formed. The Earth was formed somewhere in the neighborhood of, 4.5 billion years ago. So this is soon after the formation of the Earth, there's evidence for life existing. Life was very, very old, that's the point. So the chemist has the job in this story of trying to get from these simple inorganic substances to a simple biological substance, going from the chemistry to the biology. And the question is, how did that happen? Primordial soup is one idea that was proposed back in the early part of the 20th century, about 80 years ago. Another simile, another example of an analogy, Oparin and Haldane theory, you may have heard of, proposed the existence of a primordial soup. I tried to think of how we could make this more realistic, and it occurred to me that my grandmother's chicken corn soup would be a good example. Because after all, it has a protein in it, which is like chicken, okay? And it has RNA in it, which is like an egg, okay? And it has what are called lipids, I mean bilipid membranes, which is the corn. So we've got protein, chicken, RNA, eggs, and bilipids, the corn. In fact, this is also an example of some of the scientific groupings within Argent Life Science. You have the people who think that proteins were most important, the metabolists. You have people who think that The RNA was probably formed first, and that's the geneticist, and then you have the compartmentalist that emphasizes the bilipid membranes that have to form to make the cell. I couldn't pass up the chance to have a cartoon. We have here primordial soup again. Another image that has occurred to me since the book was written, so this is not in the book, is the example of the Rubik's Cube. There are analogies here between the problem of the origin of life and how one solves the Rubik's Cube. For example, the Rubik's Cube has only one solution. Okay? There's only one way that you can solve the Rubik's Cube. And life is singular in nature. How so? Well, amino acids. There are only 20 different R groups, and the same 20 R groups, the amino acids, exist for the E. coli that are in your gut and the cells that make up your body. Okay? Only one kind of chemistry in life. Take the RNA, for example. Okay, the nucleotides have the same pentose sugar, D-ribose, the same four nitrogenous bases, okay, exist for that E. coli in your gut as in the cells in your body. Moreover, the code that enables your cells to translate from the RNA to the protein, the code is the same. The E. coli in your gut, same code as the E. coli in your body. Okay, so there's life singularity that is just like the single solution of the Rubik's Cube. On the other side of the slide, we have multiple starting points for Rubik's Cube. In fact, do you know how many different permutations there are for a Rubik's Cube? 4.3 times 10 to the 19th. 4.3 times 10 to the 19th. Now, it doesn't matter where you start. How do you get to this? Some people can do that in about 5 or 10 seconds. Do you realize that? But in each case, they're starting from a different starting point, different path, though, for each of the different starting points. What about life? The problem is we don't know how or where it started. We don't know what the conditions were. Was it hot or cold? Either possibility. High CO2 content in the atmosphere would have made it extremely hot. Weak sun would have made it very, very cold. And science doesn't know. Where did it happen? Was it around hot springs or deep in the ocean? Those are the two most likely possibilities that are proposed these days. Those are just two examples of the multiple ways that we don't know exactly what the conditions were. That makes it extremely difficult for the scientists trying to figure out how life got started. Now, I think I'm going to skip over this slide because my 10 minutes are almost up. Or maybe I'll just mention a little bit about it because this really relates to one of the chapters in the book. Some people believe that the origin of biological information was probably the most important step in the origin of life. If you can figure out how biological information got started, then you might be able to figure out how life got to begin. And here's another analogy between biological information and ordinary information. Are they the same thing? Well, they're sequence of letters, sequence of amino acids. In one case, gives rise to meaning. In the other case, we say it gives rise to biological function. So there's an analogy here between biological function and meaning of a sentence, for example. Sequence of amino acids determines the biological function of a protein. Now, there are some among us, that is, some brothers, our brothers in the ID movement, in the intelligent design movement, who would contend that biological information is so much like ordinary information that it requires an intelligent designer. I address that question in the book, and I'm not going to tell you how I answer it.
It's a mystery.
My last slide. How do we get from here to there? That's the basic question. I want to draw an analogy here between another phenomenon that we're all familiar with. How do we get from a single cell organism, that is from a fertilized ovum, to a baby? Scientists are trying to figure this out, okay? Developmental biology is an important field. Scientists are also trying to figure this out, as I just discussed. What's the biblical perspective? The biblical perspective is in Psalm 139, 13. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. God did it. God did it. But how? That's the question. We don't have any difficulty with the relationship between these two events, okay? That is, we understand that God did it here, but if we try to figure out the science, that's perfectly okay. There's no conflict. I would argue that similarly, there should be no conflict with trying to figure this out with this idea that God did it, okay? In both instances, God is responsible, and it's the scientist's job to try to figure out how. Which leads me then to the next step in the process. I pass it on to my colleague, Ray Lewis, who's going to tell us the rest of the story.
Okay, I get to take us home here in the next 15 minutes. Once Larry gets the hard job of getting life started, I have the significantly easier job of how we get 10 million species of life from that. And here's sort of the overview of what that looks like. In fact, the theme that I would hope you would hear tonight is that the theory of evolution itself has evolved quite a bit as we go along. And science progresses, and we'll see that. Well, I start with the 10 million species, or roughly that's what we think is on the planet, because my exploration of the origin of species and the origin of the diversity of life starts with trying to understand that. And if we go back to the 18th century, when Linnaeus was trying to collect organisms from all around, especially plants, he gave us something that we still use. He gave us a way of classifying things. And so this hierarchical system of classification, maybe you remember this, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, right? We've added domain up at the top there on the last few decades. And it's hierarchical because there's one or more species in a genus, and one or more genera in a family, and one or more families in an order, and so on up the list. Now, one thing that this does that I don't think I even recognize until I really thought about it in this course, was that means some organisms are more similar to each other than another, and we've got multiple levels of similarity, right, with these categories here. And in fact, you could represent these kinds of relationships in the form of a tree. And a tree is, as you will see, a very common metaphorical way of expressing evolutionary relationships. But even, you know, in this hierarchical classification, we've got down on the bottom there, we've got a coyote and a wolf. They're in the same genus. They're closest together. The fox is in a different genus, but in the same family, you know, a little less similar. The raccoon is in yet a different family. The raccoon and the other three are dog-like carnivores. The lion is a cat-like carnivore. It's in a way different grouping within the carnivores, which is one order among the class of mammals. Now, when Linnaeus put this out, though, I mean, his way of thinking was he was attempting to discern the orderly way in which God has made the creation. And he considered the species to be static entities. They don't change. They wouldn't need to in what was considered the natural theology sort of version of the time. Well, I'm going to skip several of the scientists to get on, but if we can move right on to Darwin. Darwin was also schooled in ideas of natural theology that included static species. And, as a naturalist on a five-year journey around the planet on the Beagle, he saw lots of observations that didn't seem to fit that. And he brought his observations home in his notebook, he brought many specimens back, and over the following decades, he tried to put his ideas together, and he saw where this was going. This is not going to support static species, some sort of a change. And he knew that that would be really a tough sell. But by 1859, he published On the Origin of Species. In this book, he's got two major ideas I'd like to focus on. The first idea is this idea of evolution by natural selection, that species that individuals that show characteristics that are adaptive to the environment will tend to survive and pass on offspring in the next generation. And that using that mechanism, he surmised a way that species would change over time. And with the recent discovery of geologic time by the mid-19th century, was able to say, well, that could extrapolate to what becomes a second idea, and that is common descent, the idea of common descent, that all these organisms go back to a common ancestor. And, you can look at one of, this figure is from one of Darwin's notebooks, a tree that he drew in the late 1830s. And like I say, the tree is like a major sort of metaphor in terms of describing evolution. But Darwin, there's a lot of things that Darwin did not know about biology that were not known at that time. And one of the most important ones was how are traits inherited from one generation to the next. During Darwin's life, Gregor Mendel figured out many of the principles using pea plants, and maybe the diagram like this is familiar to you in terms of that. But this was largely ignored until the early 1900s. And when it was rediscovered, the field of genetics just blossomed and realized there's some things that seem to fit well with evolution. There's some things that don't seem to fit very well with evolution here in this. And coming up with having a new understanding of inheritance meant that a new synthesis was developed of evolution. It's typically called the modern synthesis. This is the way that evolution is most typically presented in textbooks and so on. That we have genes, we have genetic variation through sexual reproduction, we have new genetic variation through mutations, through accidental mistakes that are made in the copying of genes, and natural selection can then happen on that genetic variation. And so the modern synthesis then became sort of a, sometimes called neo-Darwinian, well, that's also applied to a different way of thinking, but a second version of evolution, if you will. We kept discovering new things about organisms, and from the fossil record, there was evidence of a rapid change instead of the gradual changes that were predicted by evolution. Genes were found to be not as simple as Mendel thought about them in his thinking, and the elucidation of DNA and being able to utilize DNA in all kinds of ways has been eye-opening in terms of a lot of the things that are going on. In fact, it's found that genes, instead of just having a gene that tells you what the organism is going to look like, no, the gene is happening functioning in the context of a network of interactions, proteins and other things. And a little change in the network can change what happens in the organism. And so from this, we get a variety of mechanisms, and there's too many for me to describe. Here's one of them, horizontal gene transfer. Genes are normally passed from one generation to the next. But if a gene is taken out of my body and put into a bacterium or something, there would be horizontal gene transfer. And that's what we're seeing here. There's much evidence for horizontal gene transfer. And it begins to transform this tree into, instead of just a branching tree, into a web of life. Another one is endosymbiosis, the mitochondria in our cells that help us to utilize food energy. That's why we need to breathe oxygen. Thought to have come from a bacterium that was engulfed by a cell sometime in the ancient past. And then eventually that engulfed bacterium evolved into a mitochondria. Same similar thing with chloroplasts that algae and plants use to photosynthesize. These two very important functions in almost life as we know it had their apparent beginnings with a mechanism like this. And this is a mechanism that Darwin had no possible idea about. So from this, perhaps we're on to an extended synthesis of evolution, or maybe even a new non-Darwinian synthesis of evolution, where genetic variation becomes a more important way of thinking about it. Natural selection is, yeah, still there, but it's just sort of a boring sorting mechanism for the amazing genetic variation that's arising. Now, in the chapter after that, we consider, well, how does this fit together with our theological thinking? And I'd like to bring in a couple aspects of the doctrine of creation. This is a huge theme throughout the book. We introduce about 9 or 10 themes from the doctrine of creation in the early chapter. I'd like to bring two themes out here. That God makes creation, or intends, God makes creation with its own functional integrity, and that creation is mysterial. That God made creation to participate in part in its own creation. Let me read a quote from the book describing one aspect. One thing we often think about with evolution is, well, what about this whole thing of randomness? In the preceding chapters, we've seen that randomness does not necessitate believing something is accidental or without purpose. Rather, we have seen how regular patterns of variation and chance are a part of the functional integrity of creation, giving creatures the flexibility and responsiveness to adapt to their surrounding conditions. Yeah, the ability to change is very much part of the adaptive ability, functional integrity. Another story might be around, more on the ministerial action. One thing that bothered Darwin was, he thought about this as a struggle for existence in terms of natural selection. And he found it's hard to reconcile with an ideas of a good and just God. So he observed ichneumonid wasps, which would lay eggs on living caterpillars. The eggs would develop into larvae and eat the caterpillar from the inside out. And he said, how could a good God allow that? Well, that's actually allowing, the caterpillar becomes a food source, provision for the wasp to continue to grow. And in fact, it's qualitatively similar to any predator-prey sort of interaction. And more than that, there's a functional, that's part of the ministerial action here, the provision part. But even in a functional integrity part, we see that controlling caterpillars can be a good thing, or otherwise the plants will get eaten too much. And so a proper understanding of the doctrine of creation can be a huge help here. I'm going to have to move on to human origins, which is on everybody's mind as we start with this course. In this part of the book, we start off with John Walton again, with Genesis. We end with some theological perspectives. I'd like to focus a little bit on the science of the fossils and the genes in the middle two chapters here. The way we can think about this is biologists look at humans within that hierarchical classification that Linnaeus put together. We fit in that group of animals. We're vertebrates, we're mammals, we're primates, and so on. You know, we fit in that. And, you know, we, of all creatures on Earth, we are most closely related to, well, chimpanzee and bonobo, kind of equally distant from humans in this, among living organisms. And so the evolutionary inference is, you see that dot right there, where that branch point is, that's inferred to be, there'd be a common ancestor for chimpanzees and humans there. That, not that humans evolved from chimpanzees, but that they share a common ancestor, is what evolution would say. Well, if we look at that, that little stretch right there, and look, okay, is there anything else happening in that? Fossil record has shown us about 20 or so species, well, would have been discerned as species from the fossil record, that that are intermediate between what might have been a common ancestor to humans and chimpanzees and humans, and we call these hominins. And there's this is a figure from the book that gives, well, some idea of a branching tree, but with really appropriate amount of, there's some uncertainty in this tree. And then in the genome, we can look at the genome and see lots of evidence for similarity between us and chimpanzees, more than we have similarity with gorillas, more than we have similarity with orangutans and so on down the tree. That our ancestry traces back to Africa. We see that in mitochondrial DNA, Y chromosome DNA. There's a lot of genetic variation in the human population, but yet not so much that we're all just human. There's no subspecies within humans. But we can't trace that back to just two individuals. Then also some evidence of interbreeding with earlier hominins, Neanderthals, and Denisovans earlier. And so in the last chapter of this section, we get to explore how to think about this theologically instead of just reacting one way or another. Let's say throwing away our faith or throwing away our science. How can we consider this theologically and in a doctrine of creation? And we cap this off in the book with this postscript. And this postscript, we hope to look at look at what this all means from creation to new creation. And in that way, the story of creation, the story of origins and understanding our origins fits with the biblical narrative from Genesis to Revelation of considering our createdness in God's image. And what does it mean as God's image bearers in creation care, in how we deal with other people? And then we'll also get to talk about, since evolution and education can be kind of a hot topic, we brought that on in here as well. What would that look like in a public school setting? What would that look like in a Christian school setting? And to explore that. All in all, we would hope that you would find not just the science, but the theological framework that we give this here helpful, and I hope you would. Thanks. At this point, yeah. We'll have questions first?
Yeah, we'll do questions. We'll take some questions.
Yeah, we'll take some questions first.
One thing that often bothers me is when we say, look at what evolution has done over these billions of years. Then it's really God who's done it. And can you really say, is that a fair thing to say, oh, evolution, look at what evolution has wrought, That's the part that bothers me the most when people talk about evolution.
I think overall, you have that, in a doctrine of creation, to realize how God's activity is through every part, that's just been more and more transformative ideas for me to get into that, and it would definitely lessen that sort of way of expressing that.
Just like a brief comment. At the very beginning of this chapter on the doctrine of creation, we talk about a kind of particular sort of false choice dilemma that you have, which is either God does everything in a way that is unmediated, right? Comes from outside of doing anything, of anything to do with the functional integrity of creation. Or it's just all these natural processes by themselves with God's, involvement whatsoever. Right. And that is the way in which I would say the vast majority of the science, faith, literature is framed. And then you try to figure out how do we make sense of God's action, so on and so forth. But if you take a perspective like the psalmist in Psalm 104, who clearly talks about the fact that it's the waters of the streams that is providing the refreshment and the watering for plants and animals, and then turns around and says, but it's also God who is doing that. Then we begin to see that this is biblical pattern, this both and. It's always God and creation. That's what we try to sweep out in this idea of the ministerial nature of creation. So when a scientist like Ray is talking about various sorts of processes, the functional integrity of creation, that leads perhaps to the divergence of new species, we can also say genuinely that it's creation that's acting, but it's also God who is the one who is doing that. And that allows, that's one way in which we think that the theological framing allows us to re-envision how to think about what it is the scientists are saying, even if most of the scientists might not have it on the front of their minds that, oh, how is God related to this? Because that's not a scientific question, that's a theological kind of question.
Did you have room to share your thinking about the development of consciousness?
No. Our editor will tell you that the book's already larger than we
double its size.
Promised.
Okay.
So,
volume two.
But that would be a follow-on volume where one gets into things like consciousness, free will, human action, and so on, which are cool topics, yeah. But we have limits.
So the comment God did it, but why brings forth the question. Brings, a common argument from secularists, which is God of the gaps argument. Are you familiar with that? Want me to explain it? It's basically, secularists saying, well, Christians are trying to explain what the mainstream science is, which is, permanent wrong or veering away from scripture, and they're saying, oh, well, God did this, we've got to find out how. So how do you respond to, the secularists giving you
So basically, the God of the Gaps argument presupposes this false choice that I just mentioned, that it's either God doing it completely apart from any natural processes or any of the properties or functional integrity of creation, or it's just the natural process. Look, well, we figured that one out. So there's less and less work for God to do. But if that's a false choice and you dissolve that choice away and you take something like the psalmist's perspective in Psalm 104, then you're talking about how it is God and creation that are always cooperatively at work. Creation's always invited into God's project. And that's a very different way of framing things. And so it's not the case that Christianity, for example, is committed to God has to do special things that the scientists will never figure out, or else, God disappears from the equation. God never disappears. He's intimately involved in everything the secular scientist claims somehow driving God out of this business. Because the secular scientist doesn't have the right pair of glasses on, right? Don't have the right lenses to be able to see, how it is God's at work through creation. That's the sort of the way we approach that in the book. I think there was one here and then here.
So back to the theme of what do you have room for in the book. It seems like you're taking on a lot of the standard mainstream scientific theories, which I think is great, and in fact a great number of them, showing how Christianity, how the Bible can be integrated, and this can reveal different ways of seeing God. Do you also take any time to go through some of the controversies that show up? I think we mentioned the intelligent design versus some of what you're looking at here, do you dive into any of the controversies?
You know, in the section on at the end of the evolution section, we go through, if you've ever seen Jerry Rao's book, Mapping the Origins Debate, he has six models of relating those. I go through those and I explore those in the context of what we just talked about, Dr. the creation and the scientific evidence for this, and try to relate those as well. And then since intelligent design is a particular one that is covered as, it's also covered in the Ryle book, but we also talk about that, what that looks like. So yeah, there was chance, an opportunity to keep that in the book.
Yeah.
And similarly, in the geology section, you heard already tonight how some of that's in the geology section in regards to a young earth creationist sort of a perspective or a flood geology perspective.
Has the book been reviewed?
I don't think anybody's published a review on it yet.
Yeah, it's like
because
it
just
came in the warehouse 2 days ago.
Right, it just showed up.
So I know, like in this discussion of like of origins, like a lot of words can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. How'd you kind of deal with that in reading or in writing the book?
Yeah, and again, I used another source to help me. For the term evolution, for example, Deborah and Lauren Harzma have written a book on origins, and they provide five definitions. So I went ahead and brought those right on in. Definition of microevolution. Pretty much everybody agrees that microevolution happens. You know, it's below the species level. Historical change over time. Common descent. A fourth version of a theory of evolution, including a mechanism for change. And then a fifth version, which is evolutionism, which is saying, okay, we can just figure all this out, so we don't need God anymore. And making the huge choice that chance of, hey, these first four, we can go there, but that fifth one, this is where it becomes a problem, is when a science is beginning to make claims that go beyond science. And that's what evolutionism is.
To what extent do you explore the theological implications of kind of contemporary scientific practice, so like top-down causation or emergence, or?
I work on emergence as part of my area of expertise, and I've written an awful lot on that, and have two other books that are in various stages of hopefully seeing the light of day soon. Unfortunately, that's another volume two, kind of thing, because although we can sort of hint at a kind of developmental picture for the universe, then there's a developmental picture for the origin of our solar system. There's a developmental picture that you can see how much we can say about it when you read Larry's chapters on the origin of life, and then similarly for the diversification of species and so on. So there is a kind of hint out there in the book that something more is going on than just sort of bottom-up processes, because after all, theologically, we already have established from our biblical perspective that God is at work in all of these things. Somehow, some way, that's sort of the ultimate top-down kind of cause. But in terms of getting into the nitty-gritty about how it is that emergence works in these sort of multi-layered ways, that breaks my heart, but we can't say anything about it. Norm.
Do the verses, John chapter 1, verse 1 and 2, do they get mentioned in the book at all? And even if they don't, would you care to comment about that?
Yes, they get mentioned early and often, not only John 1, but also Colossians 1 and Hebrews 1 and several other verses, because those are the places where we see most clearly that all things were created through Christ. And Ray made reference earlier to a Trinitarian doctrine of creation. One really needs to take seriously the fact that it's Father, Son, and Spirit that are involved, all involved in the origination of the universe, but also the ongoingness of the creation itself, and ultimately its completion in Christ and its new creation. So, take a couple more questions.
Do you anticipate or have received any pushback from the Christian community for putting Christian perspective and evolution like in the same context?
No doubt there will be some. As people can actually see this. But in terms of just like, you know, conversations with people on campus and in other sorts of environments, not any more than sort of the normal level of people going, huh, how do you make sense of that? Do those things go together? And so on.
Did you and any of the other collaborating authors like encounter differences of opinion or belief as you worked on this, and like how did that translate into the text?
We all do have sort of our own take on lots of different things, but over the years, as we've worked together to teach the course, as we've sat in on each other's lectures, we've read each other's chapters, we've made comments back and forth. We have sorted through the various issues where we had perhaps different sorts of takes on things. Most of our different takes, though, were very much sort of complementary, as opposed to being, others can perhaps speak as well, but I didn't get the sense that there were any, you know, sort of strong conflicts. There were various ways that, so what do you mean by this? Oh, okay, I understand that. I thought you were saying something else. You're kind of, so. But nothing of a sort of serious nature. Anybody else want to? So they're just going to take my word for it.
Yeah, you're right as usual.
There's another hand over there. I think, here and then here.
You mentioned the changes that have occurred since Darwin wrote his theories and so forth. How fast are these concepts changing? And if they're changing fast, how soon do we have to read the book before it's out of date?
Oh, well, tomorrow.
Addition to. Certainly changes are happening. The human origins area has just changed so rapidly. Every week it seems like
since
almost.
We started teaching the course, it was the first year of genome sequencing in 95. There have been 3,500 exoplanets discovered, and there are 18 other species of hominins that have been discovered since we just started. There are a few footnotes that were put in at the last minute for some of the newest discoveries, but no doubt any good science textbook should have unfortunately, a pretty short shelf life. That's why I have a second edition, so much.
And predicting when a new paradigm shift is going to happen is just kind of out of my league.
So speaking of human origins, Wheaton College has this document about like the natural sciences, and it seems like pretty clear, and it like repeats that the college believes in a direct creation of Adam and Eve, that are the ancestors of all humans. I'm not saying that I agree with the document or that you're wrong, but. As Wheaton College, do they have anything to say about that? Since the book doesn't necessarily go together with that.
Where to start? There's a lot of issues. A lot of issues in there. The whole notion of direct creation is an interesting one that plays into already, I think, into what we've talked about with the doctrine of creation. That God is certainly involved in all of it, and much of his action is mediated. So, that wrinkle sort of is like, okay,
Dr. Walton's coming down to rescue Ray. This is for the bullpen coming in.
The image of God is not something that can evolve. It's something that God did and only God could do. And the image of God is what makes us human. And therefore, in that sense, Since God is the one who gives his image, that is a direct act of God that makes us human.
Maybe take one more question, then we want to do a giveaway for books.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
The last comment on Dr. Walton doesn't seem to fit within the concept of methodological naturalism. How much are you constrained from the philosophy of methodological naturalism?
This book endorses methodological naturalism because methodological naturalism is simply the statement about trying to understand the properties and processes of creation on their own terms. It doesn't say anything about the fact that God isn't involved in those processes. That's metaphysical naturalism. Well, I would say many of the discussions of methodological naturalism get this confused. They actually waffle back and forth between the methodological point about trying to understand, say, how it is that electromagnetic fields work, on the one hand, and metaphysical statements saying that since we can understand a lot about how charged particles curve in electromagnetic fields, that must mean that God's not there, right? That's the central question. Methodological naturalism doesn't rule God out. It just says we're not talking about theology at the moment. We're talking about science. And once we get clear on the science, we can go back to talking about theology. So there's actually a discussion of exactly those sort of points in chapter 4 of the book. All right, so we're going to do a drawing for two books, and while John is sort of stirring that around, I should say two quick things. One is that over here, you'll find little postcards that have some information about the book. There's also a pre-special release sale, so one of these that will get you 30% off of the book. And if you are a college or university professor who represents a school that might be interested in having a course like this and you would like an exam copy of the book, there is also a little form to fill out about what that potential course might be and what kind of anticipated enrollment, you know, the normal stuff that we all do when we try to get these exam copies to think about how we might use them in the course. So you can do that actually right here tonight.
Give that form to me and I'll give you a copy.
That's right. Okay, so great. So again, thanks for coming out. We will have some refreshments, and they are down in the lower levels.
They're in the very
master. We're actually here.